This is out of the American Free Press, Freedom to Worship. Police officers in the United Kingdom who are Druids, worship Norse gods, or practice witchcraft will soon be able to enjoy the same rights and benefits as officers from other religions, including the creation of their own pagan police association, as well as paid leave on pagan religious holidays. How's that? Next one, also out of American Free Press, Cheney's Secret Hit Squad. The House Intelligence Committee's The House Intelligence Committee, I don't know if that's a redundancy or a paradox in terms. Oh, well. The House Intelligence Committee is investigating a secret CIA assassination program enacted under the Bush years that targeted leaders and members of Middle Eastern revolutionary groups. Early reports claim the agency spent at least $1 million on the 8-year program before it was reportedly called off in June after reports surfaced in the press about it. Legislators initiated the probe after it was revealed that Vice President Dick Cheney had ordered the CIA operation to be kept secret from House members in violation of the law. Legislators are required by law to have access to all intelligence programs for the purpose of regulating and overseeing them. Some reports have claimed Cheney used this program as his own private hit squad, targeting anyone the former vice president saw as a, quote, threat. Representative Dennis Kucinich of Ohio said, if this is the case, Cheney's assassination squad was in clear violation of the law. Quote, if true, these operations violate longstanding U.S. policy regarding covert actions and illegally bypass congressional oversight, said Kucinich. Cites the statute that requires a presidential finding and notification to the appropriate congressional committees. Additionally, executive order blah 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 clearly states that no person employed by or acting on behalf of the U.S. government shall engage in or conspire to engage in assassination. That's the end of the article. Dick Cheney broke the law? I don't believe it. Do you? I didn't think so. Okay, my brief commentary for today, August 19th. Recent BBC News announced that the Nigerian government officials were going after scores of Nigerian bank officials and leading businessmen who were scamming the banks for millions. I thought that was merely amusing until I remembered all the emails you and I have received over the years, allegedly from Nigerian princes and ex-government officials inviting us to make a fortune by helping them spirit millions out of Nigeria. Zounds and gadzooks, does this mean that all those emails we've been receiving over the years were true? What a strange world we live in. This next item should be filed under black comedy, or the Three Stooges are alive and well in Washington. It's from the American Free Press. Ben Bernanke, the head of the privately owned and controlled Federal Reserve, cannot remember to which foreign banks the Fed has loaned $500 billion. His lack of memory can be understood given that the Fed has loaned or guaranteed trillions of U.S. dollars to banks around the world since the U.S. economy took a turn for the worst in the summer of last year. Still, it was quite an embarrassment for the country's top banker who, during a 3-hour grilling on July 21st before the House Committee on Financial Services, admitted he did not know the recipients of foreign liquidity swaps, loans to foreign financial entities that amounted to some $550 billion, which is $500 billion. Shortly after the news broke of Bernanke on the hot seat, video of his testimony spread like wildfire on the internet, with hundreds of thousands of viewers around the world watching the chief banker sputter and squirm. Let's keep in mind that all of that is supposition. We don't know what he really felt. He might have been giggling inside. Back to the article. Here's the relevant portion of the official transcript relating the exchange between Bernanke and Representative Alan Grayson of Florida, who's also a sponsor of Representative Ron Paul's landmark Audit the Fed legislation. Grayson, what's that, the $553 billion amount? Bernanke, those are swaps that were done with foreign central banks. Many foreign banks are short dollars. Grayson, so who got the money? Bernanke, financial institutions in Europe and other countries. Grayson, which ones? Bernanke, I don't know. Grayson, $500 billion and you don't know who got the money? Grayson was following up earlier testimony by Bernanke, who said that loans to foreign banks had increased from $24 billion in 2007 to $553 billion at the end of 2008. That's a 2,300% increase in 1 year. This next part is pure banker speak. Grayson and Bernanke were debating complicated global financial transactions known as foreign liquidity swaps, whereupon the Federal Reserve gives U.S. dollars to foreign financial entities, usually foreign central banks. In return for dollars, the foreign institutions usually hold an equivalent amount of their own currencies in accounts for the Fed. Officially, the Federal Reserve states, quote, when the foreign central bank lends the dollars it obtained by drawing on its own swap line to institutions in its jurisdiction, the dollars are transferred from the foreign central bank's accounts at the Federal Reserve to the account of the bank that borrowing institution uses to clear its dollar transactions. Close quote. Translation from banker speak. The U.S. dollars, in a nutshell, are going to banks to back unstipulated loans in countries around the world. Bernanke tried to clarify the need for the swaps, saying that foreign central banks are short of U.S. dollars and come into the U.S. market, driving up interest rates. We swap our currency dollar for their currency, said Bernanke. They take dollars and lend to banks in their jurisdiction. Grayson responded that his staff had looked into some of the swaps, including $9 billion loans to New Zealand, which works out to $3,000 for every citizen in New Zealand, he said. Seriously, wouldn't it have been better to extend that kind of credit to Americans rather than New Zealanders? Putting aside the constitutionality of lending dollars to foreign banks, strictly speaking, neither the Federal Reserve nor the fractional reserve banking system is constitutional, there are considerable dangers associated with these types of transactions. Should the swapped foreign currency lose value and the foreign bank balk at paying back the loan at the agreed-upon rate, the Federal Reserve and the dollar could be dragged down with them. Also, should the U.S.-backed foreign loans go bad, the whole system could go down like dominoes, with foreign central banks taking down the Federal Reserve and the U.S. economy. It's a dangerous game the U.S. private central bank is playing with the American people's money, all the more reason why it should be opened up to public scrutiny. With no clue as to the solvency of the Federal Reserve, Representative Ron Paul's Audit the Fed bill looks better and better every day. A related item. To anyone paying attention, the entire concept of the privately owned Federal Reserve System printing our money and then loaning it at interest to our government is curious, to say the least. So one would think that Congressman Ron Paul's bill to audit the Fed would be big news. It is slowly gaining support in Congress, as is Senator Bernie Sanders' similar bill in the Senate. But corporate media refuses to cover the story. One partial exception seems to be the article I'm going to read to you out of the American Free Press. Even the voice of Wall Street thinks the Fed should be audited. This is by Christopher J. Petherick. Critics of the Federal Reserve should pat themselves on the back. Representative Ron Paul's landmark bill that calls for a public audit of the privately owned and controlled central bank has gained so much ground that even the leading voice for Wall Street in the media felt compelled to report on it. On July 20th, the Wall Street Journal published a report by economics writer Sudeep Reddy on its website titled, No Longer Alone, Ron Paul Fights the Fed. With a touch of sarcasm, the propaganda arm of the banksters and investment giants snickered that, quote, Representative Ron Paul usually stands far outside the mainstream in Congress, particularly in his campaign to kill the Federal Reserve, close quote. However, the Journal then conceded the fact that the Texas Republican now has the bulk of his colleagues standing alongside him in a fight against the central bank's autonomy. His bill to audit the Fed, House Resolution 1207, just 3 pages long, has 274 co-sponsors, every House Republican and almost 100 Democrats, and counting. Sticking with its initially derisive tone, the Journal dismissed the intent of Paul's measure with a sweeping generalization that most of his co-sponsors do not share his anti-Fed stance and are only seeking broader oversight over the private bank in charge of the American people's money. Perhaps there's truth in the Journal's gross assumption. Still, the editors there must know that should Paul's bill pass the House and Senate, for whatever reason, the Fed's fiscal practices will be investigated, and Main Street will learn that the banksters have killed the U.S. dollar by keeping Wall Street and the fractional reserve banking system on life support at a huge cost to the American public. Oddly, the Journal left in a fatuous remark by Representative Brad Sherman of California, who told the newspaper in an interview that none of the Depression-era lawmakers that gave the Fed its power ever thought it would involve trillions of dollars. Don't Sherman and the Journal editors know Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, over a decade before the Depression even happened? Ironically, at that time, advocates of the Fed sold the Federal Reserve System to the American public by claiming that it would stabilize the U.S. currency and prevent the boom-bust cycles that repeatedly plagued the country in the late 1800s and early 19th century. Representative Paul, who was interviewed by the Journal for the article, was firm in his contention that the Fed will face an audit. However, he adds, he also believes Congress and the White House will not rein in the bankers as they should, but will likely increase the Fed's power over the U.S. financial system. Quote, I think what they'll do is they'll give in to some of the transparency. At the same time, they'll give them more power, said Paul. We're going to be bugging you a lot more. We're going to be keeping eyes on you. That might be the way. Maybe, inadvertently, I'll help them get more power at the Fed. Close quote. Ultimately, if Paul's bill becomes law, and the U.S. private central bank is forced to endure public scrutiny, the last laugh may be on the media outlets like the Journal, which for years have kept Main Street America in the dark about the financial crimes that have been committed by the money men and their lackeys in Washington. It would be just deserts for outlets like the Journal to be forced to expose their masters. Okay, the next article is out of the Huffington Post. A question. Is government under Obama much different than government under Bush and Cheney? I read, you decide. It's called The Man That Brought You Monsanto's Genetically Engineered Bovine Growth Hormone is Now America's Food Safety Czar. It's by Jeffrey Smith, writing in Huffington Post. The person who may be responsible for more food-related illness and death than anyone in history has just been made the U.S. Food Safety Czar. This is no joke. Here's the backstory. When FDA scientists were asked to weigh in on what was to become the most radical and potentially dangerous change in our food supply, the introduction of genetically modified foods, secret documents now reveal that the experts were very concerned. Memo after memo described toxins, new diseases, nutritional deficiencies, and hard-to-detect allergens. They were adamant that the technology carried, quote, serious health hazards, close quote, and required careful, long-term research, including human studies, before any genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, could be safely released into the food supply. But the biotech industry had rigged the game so that neither science nor scientists would stand in their way. They'd placed their own man in charge of FDA policy, and he wasn't going to be swayed by feeble arguments related to food safety. Nope. He was going to do what corporations had done for decades to get past these types of pesky concerns. He was going to lie. When the FDA was constructing their GMO policy in 91 and 92, their scientists were clear that gene-sliced foods were significantly different and could lead to, quote, different risks, close quote, than conventional foods. But official policy declared the opposite, claiming that the FDA knew nothing of significant differences and declared GMOs substantially equivalent. This fiction became the rationale for allowing GM foods on the market without any required safety studies whatsoever. The determination of whether GM foods were safe to eat was placed entirely in the hands of the companies that made them, companies like Monsanto, which told us that the PCBs, DDT, and Agent Orange were quite safe. GMOs were rushed into our plates in 96. Over the next 9 years, multiple chronic illnesses in the U.S. nearly doubled, from 7% to 13%. Allergy-related emergency room visits doubled between 97 and 2002, while food allergies, especially amongst children, skyrocketed. We also witnessed a dramatic rise in asthma, autism, obesity, diabetes, digestive disorders, and certain cancers. In January of this year, Dr. P.M. Bhargava, one of the world's top biologists, told me that after reviewing 600 scientific journals, he concluded that the GM foods in the U.S. are largely responsible for the increase in many serious diseases. In May, the American Academy of Environmental Medicine concluded that animal studies have demonstrated a causal relationship between GM foods and infertility, accelerated aging, dysfunctional insulin regulation, changes in major organs and the gastrointestinal system, and immune problems such as asthma, allergies, and inflammation. In July, a report by 8 international experts determined that the flimsy and superficial evaluations of GMOs by both regulators and GM companies, quote, systematically overlook the side effects, close quote, and significantly underestimate the initial signs of disease, like cancer, and diseases of the hormonal, immune, nervous, and reproductive systems, amongst others. If GMOs are indeed responsible for massive sickness and death, then the individual who oversaw the FDA policy that facilitated their introduction holds a uniquely infamous role in human history. That person is Michael Taylor. He had been Monsanto's attorney before becoming policy chief at the FDA. Soon after, he became Monsanto's vice president and chief lobbyist. This month, Michael Taylor became the senior advisor to the commissioner of the FDA. He is now America's food safety czar. What have we done? While Taylor was at the FDA in the early 90s, he also oversaw the policy regarding Monsanto's genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, injected into cows to increase milk supply. The milk from injected cows has more pus, more antibiotics, more bovine growth hormone, and most importantly, more insulin-like growth factor, which they call IGF-1. This is a huge risk factor for common cancers, and its high levels in this drug milk is why so many medical organizations and hospitals have taken stands against RBGH. A former Monsanto scientist told me that when three of his Monsanto colleagues evaluated RBGH safety and discovered the elevated IGF-1 levels, even they refused to drink any more milk unless it was organic and therefore untreated. Government scientists from Canada evaluated the FDA's approval of RBGH and concluded that it was a dangerous facade. The drug was banned in Canada, as well as Europe, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand. But it was approved in the U.S. while Michael Taylor was in charge. His drug milk might have caused a significant rise in U.S. cancer rates. Additional published evidence also implicates RBGH and the high rate of fraternal twins in the U.S. Taylor also determined that milk from injected cows did not require any special labeling, and as a gift to his future employer, Monsanto, he wrote a white paper suggesting that if companies ever had the audacity to label their products as not using RBGH, they should also include a disclaimer stating that, according to the FDA, there is no difference between milk from treated and untreated cows. Taylor's disclaimer was also a lie. Monsanto's own studies and FDA scientists officially acknowledged differences in the drug milk. No matter. Monsanto used Taylor's white paper as the basis to successfully sue dairies that labeled their products as RBGH-free. Will Monsanto's wolf also guard the chickens? As consumers learned that RBGH was dangerous, they refused to buy the milk. To keep their customers, a tidal wave of companies has publicly committed to not using the drug and to label their products as such. Monsanto tried unsuccessfully to convince the FDA and FTC to make it illegal for dairies to make RBGH-free claims, so they went to their special friend in Pennsylvania, Dennis Wolf. As State Secretary of Agriculture, Wolf unilaterally declared that labeling products RBGH-free was illegal and that all such labels must be removed from shelves statewide. This would, of course, eliminate the label from all national brands, as they couldn't afford to create separate packaging for just one state. Fortunately, consumer demand forced Pennsylvania's governor, Ed Rendell, to step in and stop Wolf's madness. But Rendell allowed Wolf to take a compromise position that now requires RBGH-free claims to also be accompanied by Taylor's FDA disclaimer on their package. President Obama is considering Dennis Wolf for the top food safety post at the USDA. Yikes. Rumor has it that the reason why Pennsylvania's governor is supporting Wolf's appointment is to get him the hell out of the state after he screwed up so badly with the RBGH decision. Oh, great, Governor. Thanks. Follow-up. Ohio not only followed Pennsylvania's lead by requiring Taylor's FDA disclaimer on packaging, they went a step further. They declared that dairies must place that disclaimer on the same panel where RBGH-free claims are made, and they even dictated the font size. This would force national brands to redesign their labels and may ultimately dissuade them from making RBGH-free claims at all. The Organic Trade Association and the International Dairy Foods Association filed a lawsuit against Ohio. Although they lost the first court battle, upon appeal, the judge ordered a mediation session that took place today, and I don't know when that was. Thousands of Ohio citizens have flooded Governor Strickland's office with urgent requests to withdraw the state's anti-consumer labeling requirements. Perhaps the governor has an ulterior motive for pushing his new rules. If he goes ahead with his labeling plans, he might end up with top appointment in the Obama administration. So, that's what's happening under the Obama administration. Is it significantly different than Bush and Cheney? Avi, do you have an article for us? I should tell you that I have my apprentice, Aviel Hitchens, sitting in with me, and he's now going to read an article.
I find this one interesting, primarily because it exposes the lengths that politicians will go to obscure and defeat an issue. We expect lies from lobbyists and corporate flacks, but outright lies from elected reps? We really have an amazing political system. Here's the article from Associated Press London. UK Health System Hits Back at US Critics by Raphael G. Satter. Britain's healthcare services says it is sick of being lied about. Pilloried by right-wing critics of President Barack Obama's healthcare plan, Britain's National Health Service, known here as the NHS, is fighting back. Quote, people have been saying some untruths in the States, end quote, a spokesman for Britain Department of Health said in a telephone interview. Quote, there's been all these ridiculous claims made by the American health lobby about Obama's health care plan, and they've used the NHS as an example. A lot of it has been untrue, end quote. He spoke anonymously in line with department policy. A particularly outlandish example of a U.S. editorial printed in the Investor's Business Daily claimed that renowned physicist Stephen Hawking, who is disabled, quote, wouldn't have a chance in the UK where the National Health Service would say the life of this brilliant man, because of his physical handicaps, is essentially worthless, end quote. Hawking, who was born and lives in Britain, personally debunked the claim. Quote, I wouldn't be here today if it were not for the NHS, end quote, he told the Guardian newspaper. Investor's Business Daily has since corrected the editorial. As the debate over how best to look after American patients rages on, Britain's socialized healthcare system has increasingly found itself being drawn into the argument. Critics of the Obama administration's plan to overhaul U.S. healthcare say the president is seeking to model the U.S. system on that of Britain or Canada, places they paint as countries where patients linger for months on waiting lists and are forbidden from paying for their own medication. A Republican National Committee ad said that in the UK, quote, individuals lose their right to make their own health care choices, end quote. Another ad launched earlier this month by the anti-tax group Club for Growth claimed that government bureaucrats in Britain had calculated 6 months of life to be worth $22,750. Quote, under their socialized system, if your treatment costs more, you're out of luck, end quote, the ad says, as footage of an elderly man weeping at a woman's bedside alternate with clips of the Union Jack and Big Ben. The online attacks on Britain's healthcare system have been paired with strident criticism from Republican lawmakers. In an interview widely interpreted here as an attack on the UK, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa told a local radio station last week that, quote, countries that have government-run health care, quote, would not have given Senator Edward Kennedy, who suffers from a brain tumor, the same standard of care as in the U.S. because he is too old. Another Republican, Congressman Paul Bruin of Georgia, said that the UK and Canada, quote, don't have the appreciation of life as we do in our society, evidently, end quote. The criticism, widely covered in the UK media, has clearly stung Britain's left-leaning Labour government. The Department of Health took the unusual step of contacting the Associated Press and emailing it a three-page rebuttal to what it said were misconceptions about the NHS being bandied about in the U.S. media, each one followed with the words, not true. At the top of this list was the idea that a patient in his late 70s would not be treated for a brain tumor because he was too old, a transparent reference to Grassley's comments about Kennedy. And what of Republicans' claims that British patients are robbed of their medical choices? False again, the department said. Quote, everyone who is cared for by the NHS in England has formal rights to make choices about the service that they receive, end quote, it is said in its rebuttal. Then followed a fact sheet comparing selected statistics such as health spending per capita, infant mortality, life expectancy, and more. Each one showed England outperforming its transatlantic counterpart. The British government offers health care for free at the point of need, a service pioneered by Labour in 1948. In the 6 decades since, its promise of universal medical care from cradle to grave is taken for granted by Britons to such an extent that politicians, even fiscal conservatives, are loath to attack it. But the NHS faces significant challenges, not at least a multi-billion pound deficit predicted to open up over the next 5 years. It has critics too, particularly cancer patients, who complain that the government refuses to cover costlier drugs, leaving those who need expensive treatments to pay for them out of pocket. Nevertheless, many in British press bristled at the criticism from America's right wing. How dare the Republicans badmouth our free health care system? Guardian columnist Michelle Hansen wrote Wednesday, quote, if I'd been born in the U.S., I'd probably be dead now, end quote.
Okay, thanks. So the battle that's going on in Washington over health care and health care reform and the lies circulating about it are certainly fascinating. It's really quite an indictment of our entire political system. Next article sent in by the Grumpy Old Moose. And after reading this, you might understand why he's grumpy. It's called False Death Panel Rumor Has Some Familiar Roots. It's by Jim Rutenberg and Jackie Calms. It's out of the New York Times. The stubborn yet false rumor that President Obama's health care proposals would create government-sponsored death panels to decide which patients was worthy of living seems to arise from nowhere in recent weeks. Advanced even this week by Republican stalwarts, including the party's last vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin, and Charles E. Grassley, the veteran Ohio senator, the nature of the assertion nonetheless seems reminiscent of the modern-day viral internet campaigns that dogged Mr. Obama last year, falsely calling him a Muslim and questioning his nationality. But the rumor, which has come up at congressional town hall style meetings this week, in spite of an avalanche of reports laying out why it was false, was not born of anonymous emailers, partisan bloggers, or stealthy cyber conspiracy theorists. Rather, it has a far more mainstream provenance, openly emanating months ago from many of the same pundits and conservative media outlets that were central in defeating President Bill Clinton's health care proposal 16 years ago, including the editorial board of the Washington Times, the American Spectator magazine, and Betsy McCaughey, whose 1994 health care critique made her a star of the conservative movement and ultimately New York's lieutenant governor. There's nothing in any of the legislative proposals that would call for the creation of death panels or any other governmental body that would cut off care for the critically ill as a cost-saving measure. But over the course of the past few months, early stated fears from anti-abortion conservatives that Mr. Obama would pursue a pro-abortion, pro-euthanasia agenda, combined with twisted accounts of actual legislative proposals that would provide financing for optional consultations with doctors about hospice care and other end-of-life services, fed the rumor to the point where it overcame the debate. On Thursday, Mr. Grassley said in a statement that he and others in the small group of senators that was trying to negotiate a health care plan had dropped any end-of-life proposals from consideration. A pending House bill has language authorizing Medicare to finance beneficiaries' consultations with professionals on whether to authorize aggressive and potentially life-saving intervention later in life. Though the consultations would be voluntary, and a similar provision passed in Congress last year without such a furrow, Mr. Grassley said it was being dropped in the Senate because of the way they could be misinterpreted and implemented incorrectly. The extent to which it and other provisions have been misrepresented in recent days, notably by angry speakers at recent Tall Hall meetings, but also by Mrs. Palin, who popularized the death panel phrase, has surprised longtime advocates of change to the health care system. Quote, I guess what surprised me is the ferocity. It's much stronger than I expected. This spoken by John Rother, the executive vice president of AARP. That's the American Association of Retired People, which is supportive of the health care proposals and has repeatedly declared the death panel rumors to be false. It's people who are ideologically opposed to Mr. Obama, and this is the opportunity to weaken the president. The specter of government-sponsored forced euthanasia was raised as early as November 23rd, just weeks after the election, and long before any legislation had been drafted, in an outlet with opinion pages decidedly opposed to Mr. Obama, the Washington Times. In an editorial, the newspaper reminded its readers of the Atkion T4 program of Nazi Germany, in which children and adults with disabilities and anyone anywhere in the Third Reich was subject to execution who was blind, deaf, senile, retarded, or had any significant neurological condition. Close quote. Noting the administrative predilections of the new team at the White House, it urged anyone who sees the current climate as the budding T4 program to win the hearts and minds of deniers, to win the hearts and minds of deniers. The editorial captured broader concerns about Mr. Obama's abortion rights philosophy held among socially conservative Americans who did not vote for him, but it did not directly tie forced euthanasia to health care plans of Mr. Obama and his Democratic allies in Congress. When the Democrats included money for family planning in a proposed version of the stimulus bill in January, the socially conservative George Neumayer wrote for the American Spectator, quote, "Euthanasia is another shovel-ready job for Pelosi to assign to the states. Reducing health care costs under Obama's plan, after all, counts as economic stimulus, too. Controlling life, controlling death, controlling costs." Mrs. McCaughey, whose 1994 critique of Mr. Clinton's plan was hotly disputed after its publication in the New Republic, weighed in around the same time. She warned that a provision in the stimulus bill would create a bureaucracy to monitor treatments to make sure your doctor is doing what the federal government deems appropriate and cost-effective. This was carried in a commentary she wrote for Bloomberg News that gained resonance throughout the conservative media, most notably with Rush Limbaugh and the Fox News Channel host Glenn Beck. The legislation did not direct the coordinator to dictate doctors' treatments. A separate part of the law, regarding a council set up to coordinate research comparing the effectiveness of treatments, states that the council's recommendations cannot be construed as mandates or clinical guidelines for payment, coverage, or treatment. But Mrs. McCaughey's article provided another opportunity for others to raise the specter of forced euthanasia. Sometimes, for the common good, you just have to say, "Hey, Grandpa, you had a good life," Mr. Beck said. The syndicated conservative columnist Cal Thomas wrote, "No one should be surprised at the coming embrace of euthanasia." The Washington Times editorial page reprised its reference to the Nazis, quoting the Actian T4 program. "It must be made clear to anyone suffering from an incurable disease that the useless dissipation of costly medications drawn from the public store cannot be justified." The notion was picked up by various conservative groups, but still, as Mr. Obama and Congress remained focused on other matters, it did not gain wide attention. Former Senator Tom Daschle of South Dakota, an advocate for the health care proposal, said he was occasionally confronted with a forced euthanasia accusation as forums on the plan, but came to see it as an advantage. "Almost automatically, you have most of the audience on your side," Mr. Daschle said. "Any rational, normal person isn't going to believe that assertion." But as Congress developed its legislation this summer, critics seized on provisions requiring Medicare financing for end-of-life consultations, bringing the debate to a peak. To David Brock, a former conservative journalist who once impugned the Clintons but now runs a group that monitors and defends against attacks on liberals, the uproar is a reminder of what has changed, the creation of groups like his, and what has not. In the 90s, every misrepresentation under the sun was made about the Clinton plan, and there was no real capacity to push back, he said. Now, there is that capacity. Still, one proponent of the euthanasia theory, Mr. Niemeyer, said he saw no reason to stop making the claim. "I think a government-run plan that is administered by politicians and bureaucrats who support euthanasia is inevitably going to reflect that view," he said. "And I don't think that's a crazy leap." Javi, you got another article for us?
Yes. This one's titled, "Government Flu Vaccine Gives Its Victims a Deadly Nerve Disease." This is by Joe McFarlane of LouRockwell.com. This article seems to be out of the UK, and the government agencies mentioned are British, not American. A warning that the new swine flu jab is linked to a deadly nerve disease has been sent by the government to senior neurologists in a confidential letter. The letter from the Health Protection Agency, the official body that oversees public health, has been leaked to the mail on Sunday, leading to demands to know why the information has not been given to the public before the vaccination of millions of people, including children, begins. It tells the neurologists that they must be alert for an increase in a brain disorder called Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS for short, which could be triggered by the vaccine. GBS attacks the lining of the nerves, causing paralysis and inability to breathe, and can be fatal. The letter, sent to about 600 neurologists on July 29th, is the first sign that there is concern at the highest levels that the vaccine itself could cause serious complications. It refers to the use of a similar swine flu vaccine in the United States in 1976, when more people died from the vaccination than from swine flu. 500 cases of GBS were detected. The vaccine may have increased the risk of contracting GBS by 8 times. The vaccine was withdrawn after just 10 weeks when the link with GBS became clear. The U.S. government was forced to pay out millions of dollars to those affected. Concerns have already been raised that the new vaccine has not been sufficiently tested and that the effects, especially on children, are unknown. It is being developed by pharmaceutical companies and will be given to about 13 million people during the first wave of immunization, expected to start in October. Top priority will be given to everyone aged 6 months to 65 with an underlying health problem, pregnant women and health professionals. The British Neurological Surveillance Unit, BNSU for short, part of the British Association of Neurologists, has been asked to monitor closely any cases of GBS as the vaccine is rolled out. One senior neurologist said last night, quote, "I would not have the swine flu jab because of the GBS risk," end quote. There are concerns that there could be a repeat of what became known as the 1976 debacle in the U.S., where a swine flu vaccine killed 25 people, more than the virus itself. In that episode, a mass vaccination was given the go-ahead by President Gerald Ford because scientists believe that the swine flu strain was similar to the one responsible for the 1918 and 19 pandemic, which killed a 500,000 Americans and 20 million people worldwide. Within days, symptoms of GBS were reported among those who had been immunized, and 25 people died from respiratory failure after severe paralysis. 1 in 80,000 people came down with the condition. In contrast, just one person died of swine flu. More than 40 million Americans had received the vaccine by the time the program was stopped after 10 weeks. The U.S. government paid out millions of dollars in compensation to those affected. The swine flu virus and the new vaccine is a slightly different strain from the 1976 virus, but the possibility of an increased incidence of the GBS remains a concern. Health spokesman Mike Penning said last night, quote, "The last thing we want is secret letters handed around experts within the NHS. We need a vaccine, but we also need to know about potential risk. Our job is to make sure that the public knows what's going on. Why is the government not being open about this? It's also very worrying if GPs who will be administering the vaccine are not being warned." Two letters were posted together to neurologists advising them of the concerns. The first, dated July 29th, was written by Professor Elizabeth Miller, head of the HPA's Immunization Department. It says, quote, "The vaccines used to combat an expected swine influenza pandemic in 1976 were shown to be associated with GBS and were withdrawn from use." In a related story, it was recently reported that in the U.S., Big Pharma is way behind its production of the swine flu vaccine, and therefore, it would not be available to many Americans. Some might be upset, but perhaps, instead, we should rejoice.
Okay, I think the bottom line in that is that if some government agency or doctor recommends that you have a swine flu vaccination, you should seriously consider whether you want to do that or not. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, I'm sorry, you're now live on KVMR.
Hi. A while ago, you mentioned something on the Obama administration, how because of the people they're appointing, they're really not too much different from the Bush administration.
Yep.
Yeah, but the problem is that's the reality. But the perception by these people packing guns and I mean semi-automatic weapons, to a protest, what's their perception of reality?
I have no idea.
I don't think it meets with what's really happening out there, in my opinion.
Okay.
Otherwise, why bring a gun to a healthcare protest?
Okay.
Thanks
for your comment. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Yeah, hi. On this whole topic about the swine flu, I'd just like to point out that current science czar for Obama is John P. Holdren. And in a book that he wrote, co-authored by a couple of authors I can't think of right now, he wrote a book called Eco-Science. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that out there, but just a few excerpts that I've seen. He calls for sterilization and vaccination to control the population.
Are you quoting a book that was written in 1976?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Let's keep in mind that that's a long time ago.
One might want to research his recent comments about certain things he said and about the whole world government issue now that we're kind of shifting into the whole world government mm-hmm. scene. So,
okay.
Anyway, I just thought I'd point it out. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. Yeah, I think it's quite clear that the reason Obama was allowed to become president is because he is supporting a one-world government. My contention, and it's just my own, my contention is that nobody ascends to that high an office in the United States unless they're thoroughly in line with the overall agenda of the Bilderberger Society, and that is the implementation of one world government. We have an announcement from ubinet.com. This is for people in Paradise, the town of Paradise. It's by Joanna Gutierrez, the town clerk. This is a public information announcement regarding a severed natural gas line on Pence Road at or near 6485 Pence Road in the town of Paradise. The occupants of the Children's Community Charter School and the Fit One Health Club are safe and sheltering in place at this time. Parents should call 877-2227 for information regarding pickup of their students. No traffic is being allowed in the area at this time. Road closures. Pence Road is closed at the Pence Dean to the north and at Pence Merrill to the south. It's requested that citizens avoid driving in this area until the situation is resolved. It's anticipated that the repairs will be accomplished by mid-afternoon. Citizens are encouraged to stay tuned to local media, including Paradise Radio at AM 1500 for information. So that concerns a natural gas line severance on Pence Road in Paradise. For those of you who thought Fox News was nothing more than a bad joke, here's a scary one. Fox News on pace for best year ever. It's by David Bowder, AP television writer. South Carolina Republican Bob Inglis, frustrated by arrest of crowd at a recent forum to discuss health care reform, suggested people turn off the TV when Fox News Channel's Glenn Beck came on. Big mistake. Judging by the escalating boos and catcalls, squirting lighter fluid on burning coals would have been wiser. Beck's a hero to many people who are not buying the age of Obama, and so is Fox. The conservative network was already on pace for its best ratings year ever before the health care debate sent viewership jumping during a traditionally slow month for news. How emboldened is Fox? After President Obama's press secretary, Robert Gibbs, warned against cable news derailing health care plans, Bill O'Reilly assumed he was referring to Fox, and he seemed ready for a fight. "Who's that going to help?" O'Reilly said. "Us, that's who. Our ratings are already soaring because we don't denigrate the protesters the way a lot of other TV news organizations do. They're dying. We're on fire." Fox's strong year hasn't come without controversy. Some critics worry about overheated rhetoric. Beck has called Obama a racist and joked about poisoning House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and suggested Fox has helped lead instead of just follow the president's opponents. Fox viewership is up 11% over last year, according to Nielsen Media Research. CNN and MSNBC, which benefited from interest in the campaign last year, are down. O'Reilly, who already had cable's news most popular show, Beck and Sean Hannity, they all lead the way. The ratings exposes as naive anyone who believes that the dawn of a Democratic government in Washington would hurt Fox. Fox is much more firmly established than it's ever been, said Eric Burns, former host of Fox's Newswatch media criticism show. It's been in existence for 13 years. It knows its base, and it knows its base is bigger than CNN or MSNBC. Since Fox is already the network of choice for conservatives, the ratings indicate it must be drawing in more moderates and even liberals. This was said by Gernard Goldberg, best-selling author of A Slobbering Love Affair, The Truth and Pathetic Story of Torrid Romance Between Barack Obama and Mainstream Media. That and other books that criticize liberal media bias. The poor economy and the administration's ambitious agenda have made people anxious and searching for a media outlet that understands them, he said. Roughly three times as many Republicans said in a June survey that they regularly get news from Fox as opposed to CNN or MSNBC. This is reported by the Pew Research Institute. The three networks had about the same number of independent followers, and Fox had more Democratic followers than CNN and NBC, and NBC had GOP fans. Tim Phillips, President for American for Prosperity, a group, blah, blah, blah. Fox critics questioned its balance. Fox airs comments from 63 opponents of health care reform on Monday and Tuesday and only 10 supporters, the liberal media watchdog Media Matters for America said. Fox also cut away from Obama's New Hampshire town hall after only two questions, saying it would return if it got contentious. It never returned. Okay, you get the gist of that one. So those of you expecting Fox News to die, it ain't going to happen. Okay. Well, we're about out of time. Let's have one more George Bush thing, and I think we'll retire him then. The subject is the George Bush Library. The George W. Bush Presidential Library is now in the planning stages. The library will include the Hurricane Katrina room, which is still under construction, the Alberto Gonzalez room, where you won't be able to remember anything, the Texas Air National Guard room, where you don't even have to show up, the Walter Reed Hospital room, where they don't let you in, the Guantanamo Bay room, where they don't let you out, the Weapons of Mass Destruction room, which no one has been able to find, the National Debt room, which is huge and has no ceiling, the tax cut room, with entry only to the wealthy. The economy room, which is in the toilet. The Iraq war room, after you complete your first tour, they make you go back for a second, third, fourth, and even a fifth tour. The Dick Cheney room, in the famous undisclosed location, complete with shotgun gallery. The environmental conservation room, still empty. The Supremes gift shop, where you can buy an election. The airport men's room, where you can meet some of your favorite Republican senators. The decider room, complete with dartboard, magic eight ball, Ouija board, dice, coins, and straws. Note, the museum will feature an electron microscope to help you locate and view the president's accomplishments. Okay, we're out of time.